Okay, so yesterday we had a lot of very profound discussions, which continued after the class. And I want to highlight some of those because we are now at that stage where we need to do some thinking. We have done a lot of work. We have done a number of calculations. We have introduced a different concepts. And now we really want to think what do these things mean? So, yesterday, I introduced the order parameter for the Bose-Einstein condensate as this object, the expectation value of the destruction operator or the creation operator. And I said there was a real part, the amplitude, and a complex part, which is the phase. And one of the questions that came up is this phase something real? By real, I mean, does it have a reality or is it just some mathematical construct? Okay. And what do you think? What is your view? Do you think this phase has any real consequences? Okay, you'll see today how that comes about, because otherwise I won't be posing the problem this way. So what we saw was when the system chooses a particular, it has some freedom in terms of what theta it can pick. And typically, if you have only one ground, so it can pick any value of that theta for the ground state. So let's say it picks theta equal to zero, and that's a particular choice. So at that stage, you don't see its consequences. But when you start to bring two systems together, or when you start to perturb this theta, then you will see how it plays a role. So, one of the important consequences is that the gradient of theta. So, in other words, what you have to think about is a system in which theta is aligned. So, this is perfectly aligned. So, I can pick any direction. Let me just pick up. I'm not thinking of a ferromagnet. I'm thinking of the phase of the superfluid order parameter. It's aligned everywhere. And now imagine some kind of a gradient term, some perturbation, which makes it have a gradient like this. So I can produce such a gradient by forcing all the spins on one side to be up and another side to be, let's say, at 90 degrees. And the system responds to that like a spin wave by adjusting the phase everywhere a little bit. Deflected from the previous one, making this kind of spin wave. So now I have some gradient of theta. And this gradient of theta is like a velocity of the superfluid, of the BEC. So this is a velocity of superflow. So in equilibrium, the system doesn't want any of these gradients because it doesn't want any flow. If the superfluid flows, it costs kinetic energy. So the reason it avoids these gradients is to keep the energy minimum. But if you do produce such a gradient artificially, the superfluid will start to flow. And it will have some energy or free energy, which will go like half. You know, sort of the number of these superfluid atoms, their mass times the velocity square. So if I look at the free energy per unit volume, then that is a half rho s v s square. And rho s is called the superfluid density. Oh, shoot. This was the board at the back. Okay, let me move here. Yes. Just the gradient, the absolute phase. You can pick to be anything, so you can just pick it to be zero. So the absolute phase doesn't have a physical role, but the relative phase does. Okay, now we can, so we would like to go after this velocity and the superfluid density. And what I'm going to show you is a very nice experiment where this can be seen. But before I show you the actual experiment, let me explain what we are going to see. Okay, so we want to kind of get a measure of the superfluidity. Okay, so that's an important question that was just asked. The absolute phase per se doesn't have any real consequences, but the relative phase does. So the way we think about superfluidity is a flow of liquid flow without resistance. So no viscosity. And an example of that is helium-4. So what this experiment that I'm about to show you will do is a really beautiful experiment. It goes to the heart of what we mean by viscosity. And viscosity is a resistance to flow. So what is done in the experiment is you take a cylinder with fluid in it, and you rotate the cylinder. When you rotate it, has some angular momentum. And the angular momentum is carried by all the atoms in the fluid. And this is, let's say, happening at some high temperature. As you cool the system becomes superfluid, and that means some of the atoms, the system will start to become superfluid. So some of the atoms will lose any viscosity, and they will no longer rotate with your cylinder because it has no viscosity. It's not following the walls. It kind of falls out of equilibrium with the motion of that cylinder. So as a result, the frequency of oscillation or frequency of rotation of this cylinder will change. And that is what will be measured in the experiment. Okay, so let me write that very carefully here. So here is the geometry. You take the cylinder, it has some fluid in here. Okay, it has some radius r, the thickness d. D is much, much less than r. And this is the fluid. Okay, now when T is greater than TC, the moment of inertia, I, is given by n m r square. This is the mass of the atom, number of atoms, r square is the radius. And this I call I classical. When you go below TC, I becomes 1 minus some fraction, rho s over rho, times I classical. And what is rho s over rho? It's the superfluid density relative to the total density. So you can think of the system as having a two fluid model. You can describe the system as a two-fluid model. Above TC, the entire fluid is normal. That's rho, amount of the liquid. When you go below TC, some of the liquid is starting to become superfluid with no viscosity. And as the temperature goes down, the fraction of superfluidity goes up. So you get some behavior like this. Here is temperature, this is TC, and this goes to 1. So this is the superfluid fraction. Now, the consequence of having this two-fluid model is the following. In the rotation experiment, you have some angular momentum L, which is I times omega. Now, when you go below TC, I is changing because some of the mass is not rotating with the cylinder. It has disengaged. And as a result, I has changed, but you still want to conserve angular momentum. So below TC, so this is, let me write, L is I classical times omega, 0. And that must be equal to 1 minus rho s over rho times I classical times omega, because L is conserved as T is reduced. And that implies that the frequency at which the cylinder will rotate must go like omega naught over 1 minus rho s over rho. Okay, so the frequency is going to go up because only part of the liquid is rotating. Or I can write down the period of rotation, which is what is measured in the experiment, which is 2 pi over omega, is going to be, so period of rotation T, T is a bad symbol because I have temperature, let's call it tau, will be some tau naught times 1 minus rho s over rho. Okay, so the period is going to change in this manner. Done this horrible thing of writing on the, have I done that? Oh no, this is okay. Okay. The period of rotation decreases as the system goes below TC. Okay, yes. Rho is the total density, number of particles per unit volume. I'm sorry? It's just you take your helium at some density, at normal temperatures, right? You have a volume of the cylinder, you put some helium in it, it's that normal density, the full density. Okay, so rho is just the number of, it's just the number of helium 4 atoms you have times the mass over the volume. It's the total density.
This kind of picture, you wouldn't be able to achieve ever a clinical one, right?
You wouldn't be able to.
I mean, the infinite frequency doesn't.
Yes. So you're saying you can't really.
Would you have some quantum corrections to this?
There are. So at this point, I haven't calculated. So are you worried about the denominator going to zero? Yeah. So it'll become longer and longer. So in an experiment, you will approach it. I will show you the actual data. But you will see it will approach, rho S will approach one or rho at very low temperatures. Okay, so this is an important point. We saw that the condensate fraction, I'll just come to your question in a bit. We saw that the condensate fraction was the total density only if the system was non-interacting, right? And then there was depletion of the condensate because of interactions. And then we saw in the case of helium, the condensate could get reduced as much as to 10%. That quantity, I want to alert you, is very different from the superfluid density. Because the superfluid density is more of a response function. You are doing something to the system, like you are perturbing the phase and you're asking for the response. And even in a very strongly interacting superfluid, the superfluid density will be exactly equal to the total density at zero temperature. This can be proven by Galilean invariance. If the system has Galilean invariance, then this is true. Okay, yeah, question?
That you do work?
Okay, that's
What is the what is rotating?
What is what?
What is rotating in this
Yeah, what is
experiment?
rotating is the cylinder. So let me show you the actual experiment in just a bit. But what is rotating is the cylinder. Okay, and the liquid is rotating with the cylinder. And the question you're asking is in the normal state, of course, the entire liquid is rotating. But when you go below TC, not all the liquid rotates, just some fraction rotates. So that is what contributes to the change of the period of rotation. Okay. So what is done in the experiment, you set the system into rotation, and then you're not touching the system. Now you're just changing the temperature, and you keep measuring the frequency of rotation. So let's look at the data. Oh, yeah.
Angular momentum or not?
Yes, the superfluid doesn't carry angular momentum.
But yeah, so what's worrying me is that we said that
We cannot fill.
the angular momentum is conserved, but I can't help thinking that we have dissipation while we're above
Yeah,
TC.
I will come to dissipation.
Okay.
Yes. This,
Great.
so there are various aspects. Does the superfluid carry angular momentum? At this stage, the way I have set it up, so there is an aspect of vortices which will come in. Once the system, you start introducing vortices, then the superfluid will start to carry some angular momentum. But let's not complicate that right now. Let's assume the frequency of rotation is slow to begin with. When I'm starting out in the normal state, I don't set it up really fast. I set it up slowly. So I'm not allowing any vortices to be introduced. And then I'm looking at the change of that frequency as I go below TC. There was a question? Yeah. No?
Want to ask what is happening when we go below TC, some part of liquid becomes fluid, but why does it stop, or what happens with it? Why, how it loses its angular momentum?
Yeah, because so if you think about how something rotates, okay, when I have a wall which is rotating, how does the fluid rotate? It's because the wall of the fluid drags along the liquid. The wall of the cylinder drags along the liquid, and there must be some friction to engage.
If all the volume was rotating together, why it stops
Because it has no viscosity. It is not able to engage. with the wall any longer.
It was engaged already. It has each particle has some speed. Why it stops if it has no viscosity?
Right. So viscosity. So the wall is trying to drag the liquid, and it is able to drag the liquid when it is above TC. But when you go below TC, because the system has become superfluid, and of course, it's not like it's dragging one atom and not the other atom. All these atoms are indistinguishable, right? So it's dragging, in effect, some fraction of the liquid. So you're thinking of your liquid as two fluids, and some fraction is being dragged along.
Well, it doesn't drag it, it just rotates on its own.
Yeah, so let's look at the data. It'll become clearer when you see the data and you'll have an idea of what I'm saying. Okay, so this is what you see. The angular momentum is conserved across the transition, but the moment of inertia is becoming smaller. As a result, the period is shifting down. And at a certain temperature, this shift happens. And the system involved here is helium-4. Okay, so this is experimental data showing exactly what I sketched for you on the board. And if you plot that, so from this shift, from this expression here, tau equal to tau naught, 1 minus rho s over rho, you can extract the superfluid density. Okay, and that's shown here. Let's see. Okay, so this plot here, this is superfluid density as a function of temperature. This temperature here is 2.17 Kelvin. That is the TC at which helium becomes superfluid. And you can see the superfluid density starts to rise. Now, you know, you were worried about what happens at very low temperatures. The data doesn't go there. This is very close to the transition that there is this really high quality data from 2.16 to 2.17. In that window, you can see the superfluid density rising. Okay? So this is a consequence of the phase rigidity we have been talking about. So we discussed that there can be gradients in the phase. And rho s is a measure of the prefactor of the gradient theta square. So that prefactor is a measure of the phase rigidity. How difficult is it to change the phase of the superfluid? So if you think of it in that way, you can see that at low temperatures, the ground state looks like all the phases are lined up. It's a very rigid system. The system doesn't want to have its angles changed. And so rho s is large at low temperatures. When you look at it at any finite temperature, the system now has, it's like a spin waves have been included in your ensemble. You not only have all the spins up, but you also have these fluctuating spins included in your ensemble because you're at a finite temperature. Now, for such a system, if you try to change the gradient, it's much easier. It's a much more floppy system. So the stiffness is much smaller, and that shows up in the decrease of the superfluid density as you come down in temperature, and finally it vanishes at the critical point. Okay, so the critical behavior of this system is also very interesting. So let me discuss that. What kind of criticality can we describe, can we use to describe the system near TC? So before we do helium, let me review something about weakly interacting Bose gases. So quite some time back when we started our discussion, have these things out of place today. One second. Ah, now I know. Should open the PPT. Okay. Several lectures back, we were discussing what the energy as a function of temperature would do for these bosons versus fermions. So I'm going to go back to that discussion and then come back to that helium-4 criticality. So here is again experimental data on this is lithium-7, which is a boson, and lithium-6, which is a fermion. And what has been done here is to start cooling these atomic gases. So in the case of bosons, you see very nicely the cloud is starting to shrink. And what does that mean? What you're imaging here are these bosons in a harmonic potential. Okay, so the lowest eigenstate there is a Gaussian. As you cool the system, more and more particles are getting into this Gaussian. So yeah, this one, like this. So here is a very thermal cloud. As you start to cool it, more and more particles are getting into that lowest eigenstate. And then at very low temperatures, it's a very huge occupancy of just that one eigenstate. And that is Bose condensation, as we all know. Okay. And so for the boson case, you can see the cloud is shrinking, and it'll typically go all the way to, theoretically, to like a point, just a point state here, at which everything will be in that state. So this is still 240 nanokelvin. But if you compare the cloud for the fermionic case, you see it's much broader. And that's because these fermions feel the Fermi pressure. And beyond a certain certain occupancy, you can't push them anymore because you can't put two fermions in the same state. This is a spatial profile, but it gives you the momentum profile after expansion. So what is done is you make this cloud, and it's a spatial profile, but then you let it expand. That's how these images are made. The spatial profiles are very tiny. You can't see them. When you let them expand, you get the Fourier transform of the spatial profile, and now you're getting, this is a picture of the momentum distribution. So it's actually quite beautiful that just by expansion, you can get the momentum distribution. TF is the Fermi temperature. Okay, so if you do the thermodynamics on the system, before that. So here is the Fermi pressure. You can plot the energy. This is some other units, but this, if you plot the energy versus temperature, we were discussing this one time. At high temperatures, the energy goes linearly with the temperature, and at low temperatures, it becomes a constant and approaches EF at low temperatures. The bosons, on the other hand, have a different behavior, which is shown here. So just focus on, this is still fermions. Yeah. The bosons, on the other hand, this is, again, the energy as a function of temperature, high temperature linear, and now it falls below that and approaches zero, as some of you had said, approaches zero at zero temperature. But there is some singularity here which can be picked up if you look at the specific heat. So if you look at the first derivative of the energy, you see there is that little kink there, and that signals the Bose-Einstein condensation behavior in a non-interacting Bose gas. Okay? So in a non-interacting Bose gas, that's the nature of the singularity. But if you look at helium, its behavior is very different. So let's go back to that plot. Okay, so for helium, if you look at the specific heat as a function of temperature near that lambda near the TC that I showed you, TC is sometimes also called T lambda, just because this transition has a lambda shape, right? It's such a beautiful lambda shape. So that TC is also called T lambda sometimes. And the whole transition is called a lambda transition. But you can see right away, it's nothing like that non-interacting Bose gas with that little kink. It's this big peak going up. And if you try to come closer to the transition, so this is T minus T lambda a few degrees away from that. But now you try to come few millidegrees, and then you see this. And you come even some micro degrees, and you see this. And why are people so caught up in this? Because it starts to give you an idea what is the universality class for this transition. It turns out that this transition falls in the universality class of an XY model of spins. So we will discuss that model very shortly, but the way it comes about is by focusing on this phase degree of freedom. So the Bose condensate has an amplitude and a phase, and for the most part, we had, for the weakly interacting Bose gas, we had ignored the phase. What this is telling us is that for helium-4, the phase degree is all important. And it's the ordering of the phase degree of freedom that drives the transition. So at low temperatures, the phases are ordered. At high temperatures, there are fluctuations of these phases, and that's what drives this transition. And by writing down an effective model, which has only the phase degree, you can start to describe this transition. And that effective model is an XY model of spins. It turns out that this XY model of spins has an exponent which describes how this specific heat diverges. And that exponent is called alpha. So typically you write it as specific heat going like T minus T lambda to the power minus alpha, minus alpha. So it's very important to know whether alpha is positive or negative. And for the longest time, there was a lot of debate. So if alpha is positive, right? Suppose alpha was positive. That would say, as you came toward the transition, this specific heat would blow up. The singular part of the specific heat would diverge. On the other hand, if alpha is negative, it would tell you that the specific heat anomaly will go to zero, because you will have T minus T lambda to a positive number. Now, it turns out in the case of the XY model that alpha is a very tiny negative number. And that means that if you don't look on a very careful scale, it will look like a log singularity, like a log divergence. And that's what people thought for a long time. But in 1960s, in 1983, there were some very careful experiments done in outer space. This is the best data you will find for criticality in any system. This is the most carefully mapped out phase transition. And this system, a helium-4, was taken in outer space so that gravity doesn't affect the critical behavior. And at that point, they were able to see that with some level of confidence that alpha is indeed negative, which means while it may look like a divergence, it's actually a cusp. Okay, so that got settled. But okay, that's a whole other story. But I wanted to show that to you, that in helium-4, you don't find the expected critical behavior of a non-interacting or weakly interacting Bose gas, but you see a signature of the phase becoming important, and that driving the transition. Okay, questions?
What do you mean by being a cusp?
Oh, I mean that it'll go to a finite value and then decrease. Okay, so what I mean is, okay, let me. What I mean is, the specific heat as a function of temperature, there is always some regular behavior. There's always some background. When we talk about these singularities, they ride on top of some background. And the question is, at T lambda, at t lambda, suppose cv went like little t to the power, little t is by t minus t lambda over t lambda. If it went to, so if, let's say if alpha is greater than zero, then we expect that at this point, the specific heat will diverge, okay? So alpha greater than zero implies divergence. Then CV goes like T to the minus alpha implies divergence. On the other hand, if alpha is less than zero, CV will go like T to the minus, T to the plus, let me write mod alpha. Okay, so this implies a cusp. And by that, what I mean is that this will do, something like that. So it'll pick, it'll go back to the background like this without a divergence. So that's a cusp. So this is how much effort it took to address this question. But it brought out the importance of phase fluctuations.
So the cusp doesn't go above the background?
No. It approaches it from below. They have removed the background. The background has been removed. So it looked.
Was quite high in this.
Yes, yes. Okay. So now let me go to the. Did I lose it? Okay. So what I want to do next is to look at the phase degree of freedom, which has now reared its head. And the model that it is taking us toward. Oh yeah, sorry. I wanted to show you a film, so let's do that. We can take a little break and have some entertainment here. This is, so helium-4 is a really, really cool system. I don't know how many of you have, I can't say played with it, it's very low temperatures, but the reason I'm saying it's a cool system is because of the funny phase diagram it has. So, so helium-4 phase diagram. Looks like this. Here is pressure, here is temperature, and what we have just seen is, okay, I won't worry about this, there's a little bit of gas, liquid here. When we go below some temperature, which I said was 2.17. It becomes a superfluid. So this is T lambda. And this is how it behaves as a function of pressure. It changes a little bit. And this side here is a superfluid. And what you see is that even at zero temperature, the system has not solidified. That's the only example we know of a system which does not solidify at zero temperatures. So this remains a liquid. In fact, a superfluid even at t equal to zero. And that's because of quantum effects. Because of the zero point motion. So it remains a superfluid, and you have to apply pressure, almost 25, I don't have the number here, but I'm talking from memory, about 25 bars of pressure to make it into a solid. Okay. And what is also interesting, I'm not going to go into that here, but it has a very, I don't know how many of you remember this Clausius-Clapeyron equation from some of your statistical physics courses. You heard about that? It tells you about how these phase lines look like in the PT plane. And they typically should bend in that direction. So the dP by dt along a coexistence curve. This is taking me a little outside what I want to say, but since it has come up in helium, let me say that, is given by sort of delta S by delta V, the volume change across the two phases. Okay, and this holds for any two phases. And this would typically imply that if I go from, so typically this would give me lines like this. This would be the norm, usual behavior. P, T, that's some triple point. This is, let's say, some gas, liquid, solid. They bend in this positive slope. And that's because when you go from a gas to a liquid or a liquid to a solid, you are always reducing the entropy. And the volume is also going down. So you get a positive slope. In the case of helium, something interesting happens here. When you go from the superfluid to the solid and it has this opposite slope, it indicates that the liquid has lower entropy than the solid. So this slope here implies, this opposite slope implies that the superfluid has lower entropy than the solid, which is rather neat, you know, that a liquid should have lower entropy. Liquid is much more disordered, but because it is a quantum liquid, it ends up having lower entropy than the solid. And this line is also weird. But this, of course, one can understand because between the ordinary liquid and the superfluid has a lower entropy. And in fact, water, even without being superfluid, our ordinary water is also anomalous. And that will take me even further away from what I want to say, but let's just, you know, we are going to experience snow very soon. And the reason you guys will be able to skate and not me because of my abilities, but the reason most of you will be able to skate is because of another reason that, so this is the liquid, solid, gas, this is water. And here the anomaly comes, this funny slope here, the opposite slope comes not because of entropy, but because ice is less dense than water. So it's coming from the denominator having the opposite behavior. So it's kind of useful to see how thermodynamics kicks in. Okay, so let me show you the movie. So that's the object we are talking about, helium-4. Let's get some lights down.
There were more surprises ahead. In the 1930s, another strange phenomenon was observed at even lower temperatures. This rapidly evaporating liquid helium cools until at 2 degrees above absolute zero, a dramatic transformation takes place.
Suddenly, you see that the bubbling stops and that the surface of the liquid helium is completely still. The temperature is actually being lowered even further now, but nothing particularly is happening. Well, this is really one of the great phenomena in 20th century physics.
The liquid helium had turned into a superfluid, which displays some really odd properties.
Here I have a beaker with an unglazed ceramic bottom of ultrafine porosity.
Ordinarily, this container with tiny pores can hold liquid helium. But the moment the helium turns superfluid, it leaks through.
We call this kind of flow a superflow.
Superfluid helium can do things we might have believed impossible. It appears to defy gravity. A thin film can climb walls and escape its container. This is because a superfluid has zero viscosity. It can even produce a frictionless fountain, one that never stops flowing. Superfluidity and superconductivity were baffling concepts for scientists. New radical theories were needed to explain them.
Okay. So, yeah, so it's really amazing, this liquid. And it, yes, so I should mention the person at the beginning who talks here is Alan Griffin. He was a professor at University of Toronto, did some very beautiful work on collective excitations in these superfluids, and unfortunately recently passed away. But you know, he left his legacy through his work and these movies. But yeah, so you see what a sneaky little object it is. Okay, and the main point I want to connect with our theories is it's all coming because of the gradient of the phase. So the gradient of the phase is a reality through these superflow properties. Okay, now let's look at an effective model to describe this. So you might say, these are of course interacting bosons, we can write down a Hamiltonian and just crank up the interactions. But again, in terms of our general philosophy of extracting effective models, the way to discuss the critical properties of this system would be to just think of the phase and what kinds of interactions these phases have. So let me again show you some slides quickly, and then we will get back to the board. Okay. Okay, so here is the Hamiltonian for an XY model. There is J is the coupling, SI dot SJ are the spins on a lattice at different sites. Now, what is the analog of this for? You can have exactly spin systems which have this Hamiltonian. Here, this bosonic system gets mapped into this because each SI is like an amplitude and a phase. And I can pull out the amplitude. I can say, well, most of the action is happening in the phase, so the amplitude is constant. And then it becomes, so it's like saying my N0 at I and N0 at J are not changing. I can just absorb it in this coupling here. And then I have a Hamiltonian, which is cosine theta I minus theta J, where these are continuous variables at each site. It's a U1 symmetry. Right, so theta I can be anywhere on a circle. So that's the Hamiltonian. In the ground state, all these spins would be perfectly aligned. But at finite temperatures, it will have these kinds of fluctuations. Yes? Yes, so this would be a three-dimensional lattice for helium-4. Okay, I'm now going to, so helium-4 liquid that we were talking about would be a three-dimensional lattice, but you can also take helium-4 and put it on a film, and then it would become like a two-dimensional model. And what I'm going to do next is to focus on two dimensions. Why? Because two dimensions will allow me to discuss certain very interesting topological defects in them called vortices, and that's what they look like. So if I take a helium film, two-dimensional, or just spins in two dimensions, you can get these kinds of topological defects. And what I mean by topological is the following. So if I look at, so here are my thetas. They are sort of circulating around. And if I take an integral along this loop, you will get 2 pi times an integer, which is called the winding number, or the vorticity. Okay, so I've shown you sort of a vorticity of 1 and minus 1, and these are the patterns it would make with the phases. So that's a vortex and an anti-vortex. Now, as a function of temperature, what you will see is, so as we know that we did this for the crystal in 2 dimensions. So there's something called the Merman-Wagner theorem, which we saw in action through the Debye-Waller factor. And what we showed there was that in 2 dimensions, you did not have any perfect crystals because the phonons destroyed long-range order. The same effect plays out here in these XY models. So the Merman-Wagner theorem states that for a continuous symmetry, for example, U1 or O3 or any of these Heisenberg XY models, in D equal to 2 or D less than equal to 2 and finite temperatures, there is no long range order. There is no long range order. And so the long range order is destroyed by spin waves. So spin waves are these slow fluctuations. And that is enough to destroy long range order, and it will give you a correlation function SRS0, which goes like 1 over r to the power alpha, where this is called algebraic decay. And so if you had spin waves, they would destroy this long-range order at all temperatures above 0 and give you an algebraic decay for the spin-spin correlation function. But now what you're going to see is that these models in 2 dimensions allow for topological defects, so-called vortices. And the effect of these vortices is to produce a phase transition of a very different kind. And that is called a Koslitz-Thouless phase transition. Oops, sorry. Okay. So here is T. Berezinski, Koslitz, Thouless, to honor all the 3 people who worked on this. This is temperature here. And what they showed was that at low temperatures here, there is a vortex, anti-vortex bound. And here the vortex, anti-vortex are free. So there's a vortex, anti-vortex unbinding transition at a particular temperature. And the consequence of this unbinding is that below TKT, this correlator, let me just define this correlator by G of R. So here, G of R goes like 1 over R to some power. Actually, it's usually called eta of T. So it's called eta of T. And at the transition here, eta has a specific value of 1/4. But for all temperatures below TKT, eta is a continuous exponent. Okay, so what is interesting here is typically you have seen algebraic decay at a phase transition. At a single temperature, you have correlations which become algebraic. In this case, the entire phase has algebraic decay. So the entire phase here, you can think of as being critical in a way, with an exponent which varies with temperature, and at the KT transition, it has a specific value of a quarter. Above the transition, now the vortices are free. They start destroying this algebraic order, and you get back an exponential. So the correlations once again become exponential with some length scale xi. Okay, so that's the basic behavior of the KT transition. And so here are some simulations which shows this feature. Again, for the XY model, as the temperature is increased, you see that at low, so the TKT in these units is around 1, somewhere here. When you're at temperatures which are much lower, you get vortex-anti-vortex pairs. And there should be equal numbers of vortices and anti-vortices. This is just showing part of some system, so there is another missing blue somewhere else in the system. Okay? So at low temperatures, there are equal numbers of vortices and anti-vortices. That's true everywhere, because you haven't produced any bias. But at low temperatures, they are bound. They come together. At high temperatures, they start unbinding. And as they unbind, they destroy the long-range order. So think about what a vortex is doing. It's twisting the phases around that point. So it's a way of it's destroying the perfect organization of these phases in the ground state. And so long as they are bound, then around the region where you have the vortex and the anti-vortex, there are some phases which are distorted. But at large distances, the field cancels, and you get pretty much the undisturbed phases. But as these vortices now start to unbind, they completely destroy the phases and destroy this long-range phase coherence. OK? Keep asking me questions if you have any. Here? So you know, you have to calculate. So you're right. These snapshots are only giving some hint of what is happening. You really have to go and calculate these correlators, spin-spin correlators, average them over the thermal distribution, and then look at this scaling. So this, it may not be totally evident. One thing is evident, you're getting many more vortices, right? But they will also tend to be further apart, which one is not able to see here. But if you look at these correlators, you will see this correlation function. And we can, So let's see. We can actually estimate very quickly what this energy, what this temperature scale will be. So we can we have this Hamiltonian, which is minus j cosine theta I minus theta j, sum over ij. And this j is actually the energy scale of that is like the superfluid density. And you can see that if I just go to quadratic order, I make a continuum, then this would go like j over 2 integral dr over the lattice constant square. This is a two-dimensional integral, delta theta square. So I'm looking at the XY model. And so the energy of a vortex would go like J over 2 pi over a square integral r dr, and delta theta is like a over r. So here is the vortex. I look at a field at a distance r away. These are my different points on that, these lattice points, and this is delta theta. So delta theta is a over r. And then for such a field, what you get is a log divergence. It goes like, so this goes from 0 to L, that's the system size. And that gives me pi j log. Here also I have a cutoff, L over A. So that's the energy. And as you know, all of these phase transitions are the competition between energy and entropy. And that's what drives the transition. So we should see, what is the entropy of a vortex? And the entropy of a vortex is coming from the fact that I can put this vortex in many places, in the number of sites divided by the area of a plaquette. So if I have a plaquette like that, I have a lattice like that, the center of the vortex is sitting somewhere here, and that's how I get these patterns around it. But the number of possibilities this is A. This is L. And so S is KB log L over A square. So the free energy is E minus TS, and that is pi J minus 2 kBT log L over A. And so at low temperatures, this dominates. And that dominates at high T, because each time you're trying to minimize the free energy, and that competition then drives the transition at, so an estimate for the transition, KBTC is equal to pi J over 2. And it's not really equal, it's of that order, because this is not an exact theory. There's an RG theory you can do for this, which can give you the precise estimate of TC. But it's very close to this very rough argument that you can use to get an estimate. So the vortex, so what has been done to, so a vortex, you should think of it, ideal case, as a field of phase pattern of this kind. Now, how do you tell that you have a vortex? You go and do this integral. At each site, you go, so that's how those yellow and blue points have been placed. So at each site you go and you evaluate this line integral. And you see if it gives you 2 pi times an integer. Okay? If you get that, then you mark it either blue or yellow based on whether it's plus 1 or minus 1. So there will be all this fluctuating pattern. Some of it is just spin waves. You don't care about that. What you care about are the topological defects that would have this winding number. No, it will produce them in equal numbers because there's no net vorticity on the system. Vorticity is like an angular momentum. So if I suppose I were to rotate the system and put in angular momentum, now I can have more vortices compared to anti-vortices. But if I have not provided any angular momentum, then this would be, it will always have equal numbers. You don't see it in the simulations because, as I said, this was some portion of the lattice. For the winding.
Yeah.
Yes, you always get an integer. When you do get winding, you will get either 0 or 1 or 2, and that is what makes it topological. Yeah. It is. No. It's DL dot with this. So if it's winding the other way around, so think of this as a field with something, think of it as a magnetic field. So I go around, there's a current, you go around the current loop and there is a magnetic field that comes out of the board, or it goes around the other way and the magnetic field goes into the board. In fact, we will see in the superconductor these vortices being generated by magnetic fields. And okay. Yeah, it's the directionality is going to be opposite for the anti-vortex. You take the line integral, and in one case, you can see that the line integral will give, you can see there's a net winding just by rotating your hands. So, okay. So that may be bad. So here, okay, forget that picture. Here, if I just reverse all the arrows, okay, so if I take this pattern and I reverse all the arrows, I will get a negative vorticity. Yeah, so take the vortex field and just reverse the arrows.
So the point is, you could, whatever one it is, you could then do a global rotation without changing anything.
Yeah.
And that makes the picture sort of less clear.
Right.
I mean, this right-hand picture presumably is a rotated version of what you just described.
This one, the right-hand picture.
Right-hand.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this, it may not have been generated correctly. It may not have been generated correctly, yeah. But the better thing is you take this vortex pattern that I have on the left and reverse the arrows. So I like to think of it as current loops that run around in one direction clockwise versus anti-clockwise, and that gives you vorticity in one direction as opposed to another.
So anti-vorticity is just vorticity.
It's vorticity in the opposite direction. Yes.
Here you're trying to find the phase transition into the deconfined phase, right?
Yeah, so this TC is what I had called TKT.
Yeah, so you also need probably the entropy of placing the anti-vortex.
But I just mean vortex and anti-vortex, all of these defects. Yeah, I'm not distinguishing. I'm just saying these defects can be placed in various places. Okay, so now, so we have seen what it does to the correlation function. It does not change the behavior below the transition because they are bound, and you still continue to see the algebraic decay of the due to the spin wave, but above it makes it exponential. So that's in the correlation function. What about the superfluid density? The superfluid density has a very different behavior. So you can see from the correlation function, I cannot define a condensate fraction, right? The condensate was the long distance behavior. That constant gave us the condensate fraction. There is no such constant at large distances. So the condensate density is zero, but the superfluid density, which is a response, is finite in the bound phase. So in the phase which is confined, to use your language, which is confined, the vortex antivortices are bound up, the superfluid density is, this is just a sketch, I will show you real data in a bit, but the superfluid density is 1 in units of the total density, it's 1, it decreases, but unlike what you saw in helium-4 in 3 dimensions, there it decreased continuously to 0. Here it decreases, and then at a certain temperature, the KT transition, it jumps. And this jump is a universal value. So this is a universal jump to 0, and then it remains 0 above that. Now, this is a prediction from that KT theory. So here is the data in helium-4. Okay, so let me again reduce the lights a bit. Okay, so here is the data in helium-4. So look at the lower panel. You see that the superfluid density decreases, again measured by looking at the period of oscillation of that torsional oscillator. And then there is this jump. And you can actually track this jump by looking at the line which is proportional to temperature with that universal slope. And that was first observed in helium films. And what is also interesting is that if you look at the dissipation, and I won't go into this in too much detail, but there was a question about dissipation. So I want to show you this here, that in 3D systems, these transitions are not associated with any dissipation. But in 2D, because you have these vortices, and these vortices can flow, they can cause dissipative effects. And that shows up as a very sharp peak, very close to the transition. So you get this additional peak here. Because of the unbinding of vortices, they can now lead to dissipation. Okay, but let's not go there. At least you can see this very nice jump. And then what they did in the experiment, they reduced the amount of density, and as that was reduced, the jump, this TC also came down, but there was always that universal jump which was seen. So that sort of completes some of what I wanted to show you in the experiments on these vortices. Okay, let's see, there was a question there? No, somebody raised a hand. Okay. Okay, so that completes what I had to say about bosons, and we have seen the story with the weakly interacting, the strongly interacting, the role of the phase, and now we are ready to move to superconductors. What superconductors brings to the table are some aspects which are very similar to the superfluids. In other words, there will be an order parameter again, like we wrote down, which will be the, as opposed to the bosonic operator, now we would make a fermionic operator, but a fermion cannot Bose condense. So by definition, fermion cannot Bose condense. So we will use 2 fermions to make a bosonic field, and that will again get an expectation value. It will have an amplitude and a phase, and a very similar story will unfold. But what is interesting is that this is a charge field. So it will couple to the electromagnetic field. And as a result, we will get some phases, new phases with vortices. So we have seen today these vortices in two dimensions. We will take superconductors and put it in a magnetic field and see how you get vortex lines, which are vortices in higher dimensions, and what how these vortex lines can organize themselves. So that's what I will do starting Monday. Okay, so I'm actually done, but if you have questions, you should take the opportunity to ask some. Yeah. That data was in, so I showed you both 2 and 3D. The one I just showed you was in two dimensions. So, yes, so let me put that up again. So this data which I just showed was in 2D. This is in 2D. It's a superfluid film. Okay, now since it's experimental data, it's not going to just jump, right? Theoretically, it's a jump, but experimentally, there will be some rounding. So, but the amount of rounding can be characterized in the experiments. So it is indeed fitting very well the theoretical prediction, and that is shown here. You can take these films with different amount of helium in it, and you can scale it with TC, and it's this perfect line. And that line is the universal number. So it agrees extremely well with that. OK, a question?
How would you find a winding number?
Just by that. You do that integral on the lattice. At any distance r, you look at the theta field, and you do the line integral. And 2 pi times the integer would be the winding number. Well, you know, if you go far enough away from the center, right, it becomes a continuous field, right? So the discreteness of the lattice doesn't matter. When you go far enough away, it becomes a continuous field. And the coarseness of the lattice is not going to be important, and you can then take the line integral. But, you know, you don't even have to do that. You can even, if you look at the discrete values, you can just take delta theta, times delta. You can take finite differences and still define this. Right, there is an ambiguity. That's true. But because it is topological, you can go far enough away, and the winding number is independent of where you take your R. Right? You can take R anywhere and then go around. Okay, thanks. Yeah. So the superfluid density is defined by that gradient theta. So what you do is the following. Let's say I have at any finite temperature, I'm going to get some configurations which will have some disorder, right? Thetas are not going to be lined up. I'll have some configurations with disorder. Now what you can do is there are a couple of ways of defining it. One is the simplest way to visualize is to try to twist the boundary conditions. Okay, so I have solved my problem in a certain boundary condition system. I twist the boundary. When I twist the boundary, the energy will go up. And I just calculate the energy or the free energy with this twisted boundary and take the difference and so on. And from that, you can get the stiffness. So it's exactly how you visualize it. It's the stiffness to changes in the boundary condition, or the energy cost to changes in the boundary condition. Other questions? Yeah.
Shouldn't there be some kind of R x in the definition?
Some what x? Both are vectors. So one is the gradient of theta is pointing along the line integral. And I'm just taking the dot product of that with dl. OK, let's discuss that a little more. Let me see. Are there other questions? Okay, well, see you on Monday then.